Good morning. Okay, I asked this earlier, and we seem to have filled in a little bit. Particularly for this session, I noticed when I was singing yesterday, because of the way the acoustics are of this particular room, it was hard for me to hear some people. So the closer we can all be together, I think the better this session will be. And if you want to be close and cozy for one session and then spread out, I'm okay with that. But if you'd like to make that adjustment, now would be a good time. Thank you. I understand. I'll go ahead and begin talking. The first few things that I have to do are talking anyway, and much of it may not be all that important to anybody but me, so go ahead and adjust as I continue here. Other than my immediate family, two of the people that I hold dearest in my life are my wife's parents. Many of you know them, many of you do not. Gerald and Mary Crown. And specifically concerning my wife's mother, Mary Crown, I don't know that I know a more loving person than Mary Crown. And the jokes about mother-in-laws that you hear, they just don't apply in my case. I love my mother-in-law very much. My wife accuses me of marrying her so that I could be closer to her family. Well, that's not the only reason I married her. I can't deny it. I did want to be closer to her family. They are wonderful people, and they're good people to be a part of. They're a very strong attraction for me and continue to be. And just so happens, through the years, my wife is becoming more like her mother. And that's a good thing. I like that in my wife. My wife has had the unfortunate experience of having two of her siblings precede her in deaths. A sister, Connie Crown, died in an automobile accident in 1977. And a brother, Peter Crown, died in a helicopter accident in 1995. Although these deaths were very hard for all of our family members, I know they were particularly difficult for my mother-in-law, Mary Crown. In the normal order of things, we expect our children to die after we do, not before. I mention all of this because I see in the recent circumstances some parallels between those deaths and the early death of our brother Clint Sparks. When I spoke to Lynn Sparks at Clint's funeral 2 days ago, I was prepared to mention to her that coincidentally, I had just visited her brother, Chris Neister, in Montana, and to convey their love to her. I did that, but in my attempts to comfort Lynn, she comforted me. She thanked me for taking this class, the class that I'm about to teach here, these 2 weeks, so that Rick could be home with her. Sometimes I'm kind of slow, and I was at that moment. Really, the ones to thank here are the elders of Vandalia. They made that decision, and it was clearly the right thing to do. And Lynn just confirmed that in that conversation that we had at the funeral. A husband and wife who have just lost a child need to be with each other. Because of the physical distance between us, I usually only see Rick Sparks once a year at these studies. and I was looking forward to his class. I'm certain that many of you would rather have Rick up here right now than me. I would rather have Rick up here right now than me. But Rick and Lynn need to be with each other right now. So we do this instead. So out of our love for them, you will tolerate me. And we will do this. If you expected this to be as good a set, most of you guys know both of us, so you know what you're getting into here. If you expect it, but if you don't know me and you know Rick and you expect this to be as good as something Rick would do, you're going to be disappointed. I'm sorry. So let's just clear that up front here. And you know, the best way for you to avoid disappointment here, just don't have any expectations at all. And we'll be fine. I do want to say one more thing. Just, I don't know, I think it's kind of interesting. I'm not one into numerology by any means, so don't misread this, please. But it just so happens that July 21st was Connie Crown's birthday and Peter Crown's death day. And although Clint died on July 20, it was July 21st that most of us got the word. Okay, one of the things we're going to do here is we're going to do a little bit about how to read music. We're not going to spend a lot of time on that, but we're going to spend a little time on that. And I feel compelled to justify why that's even appropriate, maybe. I'm going to justify it whether or not you think it's appropriate for me to justify it and whether or not you agree with my justification. But here we go. Music is an important part of our lives as Christians. And our culture has a system of written music notation. And the schools often do not do a good job of teaching all students how to read music. It really varies where you go to school, or if you're homeschooled, the background of the parents who are doing the homeschooling. And sometimes you get students with a tremendous music education and sometimes students with a very poor music education. There's a lot of inconsistency with it. I remember years ago, I happened to notice Phil Robinson leading songs, and he was using a tuning fork to pitch the songs, and I watched the process he went through, and I spoke to him afterwards. I said, how do you do that? What is it that you're doing? And he confirmed what he told me what he did and confirmed what I thought he was doing, and it was certainly a good method, because a tuning fork only gives you one pitch, and lots of times that's not the pitch that you want to really start at on the song, so you have to do some sort of manipulation to go from whatever that pitch is on the tuning fork to whatever pitch you want to start the song. And he told me the process that he went through. And I said, where'd you learn how to do that? And he said, it's school, in public school. When I went to school, he said, we learned the do, re, mi's right along beside the ABCs. Everybody did it. The teacher played piano, we sang, we read music, we learned how to read music. It was part of the public education curriculum. And I thought, wow, he's my parents' age, if you don't know, he's now passed on, but, and I thought, wow, how things have changed, because it's certainly not in where I am. I mean, if you take music classes, you'll learn, but if you don't, you don't. And it is my opinion, when the schools do not teach something that is important for our Christian lives, it is acceptable or even necessary for the church to do this teaching. Imagine for a moment a situation in our country in which English was the main spoken language of the people, but the schools didn't teach people how to read English, for whatever reason. We would probably have little reservation about the church teaching people how to read English so that they could read the Bible in the same language that they speak. When the schools do not teach something that is important for our Christian lives, it is acceptable or even necessary for the church to do this teaching. There is nothing sacred about the English language, except perhaps that it derived from something that God gave at the Tower of Babel. But beyond that, The notation system that we use, the development of the way the language has come, I do not believe to be anything sacred or God-given, specifically. There are plenty of other languages that are just as good as English in this world, if English is any good at all, for that matter. I really struggle with spelling in English, and I wonder sometimes about our language. It is simply the language of our culture, and it is good for Christians to know how to read English. There is nothing sacred about our system of music notation. It is simply the notation system of our culture. And it, in my opinion, it is good for Christians to know how to read our system of music notation. Interestingly, more cultures of the world use our system of music notation than speak our language of English. Our system of music notation, what they talk about, music is the universal language. Well, maybe it's not completely worldwide universal, but just this system of music notation that we use with notes on the staff is used virtually by every developed nation in the world. And that's all I want to do on that presentation. I'm not an engineer. In case that was important to anybody. I'll give you a trivia question for tomorrow, though. Okay. You know, I did think about engineering as a course of study, and I looked at all those courses. Some of them are pretty hard. Well, that's not all so bad. I think I could probably get through most of that. But you go through all of that study, and then they still don't let you blow the whistle on the train. So I decided not to go that route. Now, there is a reason in our language why the word engineer applies to the operator of the train who does get to blow the whistle. And it also applies to people like Grant and David and others here who are engineers by profession, by education, who design things, automobiles and bridges and roads and electrical systems and all kinds of things that engineers design. There's a reason why we use that same word for the person who operates the train and the person who designs the automobile. And your trivia question is to find out why we use the same word. You may know. If you know, don't shout it out. Why do we use the same word? Remind me to ask that for the answer tomorrow. Why do we use the same word for both of those occupations, which really seem very different, operating the train and designing a computer? Okay. So I think that's all I want to do for introduction. Is my time up yet? Oh, okay, we'll do something else. Handouts. You should have three. Okay, here's a hand. Do you have any? You have two. Okay, the three should be a handwritten one called Psalm 1, verses 1 and 2, and then I didn't get them back, so I can't hold them up. One of them is the Elijah song. It's in nice printed English, so she needs an Elijah. And the other is blank staff paper. The staff has five lines that go horizontally parallel to each other. So our passers out are handling that. The blank staff paper is for you to take notes. Now, while they're passing out papers, I'm going to do a demonstration here. It worked. I tested this yesterday, and I don't think between dinner and breakfast this morning that I gained too much, so I should be able to do this. I'm going to lie down here on purpose. And if it collapses, well, first of all, it'd be really funny, but there's not much I can do about that at that point.
Don't break it, okay?
I'll try not to. Okay. What I want you to do here, I'm just going to lie still and breathe. And I want you to notice what moves besides my lips.
And the table.
And the table, yeah. And what, I want to get my arm out of the way here so you can see my chest and my abdomen area and stuff. See what moves and what doesn't move. And I'm just going to lie still and breathe. Okay, what part's moving?
The stomach.
The stomach, the abdomen area. Is this moving?
No.
No. When you lie down, particularly if you lie flat, with no pillow or no elevation to the head or the chest, the chest area just naturally kind of falls this direction. And all the breathing movement is here. This is what we want when we sing. We want the breathing movement here. And you can test that out at home. It'd be nice if we could do it here, but we just don't have the room. So we won't have you do that. But, you know, tonight or sometime, find a flat place to lie, take the pillow out for a minute, and notice, sure enough, the chest raises, in essence, and stays still, and all the breathing is done from here. Watch an animal sleep, a mammal, like a dog or a cat. Cats, there's plenty of time to observe them sleeping. You know, you got to wait more than 20 hours just to be sure if the cat's comatose or just sleeping, you know. There's a cat that lives at our house right now, and I watch her sleep, and sure enough, the same way. The rib cage doesn't move. All the breathing is from the abdomen area. And now, when we're upright, when we sit or stand, sometimes we let this fall. And then when we try to breathe, we let it go like that. And that's way more work than we need. And it doesn't help us with good breathing. To sing, you must have inspiration. And one of the meanings of that word is to breathe in. You also must have expiration. Because actually that's when the singing is done, is when you're expiring. Isn't our language fun? So here's, I'm going to stand sideways to you, and I'm going to do the two-hand system here. I'm going to keep one hand here on my chest, and one hand here on my abdomen. And let me talk about posture here. With what I'm doing here with my body, I'm standing straight, not stiff. Not shoulders high or any of that, just straight. Imagine maybe a string just pulling up right through the center of the spine. And then everything else just kind of relax and falling into place. But it keeps the chest high. And then, so I'm going to breathe out now. And if I breathe all the way out, and then hold it, and then after I just release, the air comes in. So taking a breath is really just, you almost create like a vacuum in here. And then when you breathe, it fills it up. You don't have to go to get the breath. For one thing, it takes more time. For another thing, it doesn't really give you a good breath. The full breath is when the chest is high. Like that. Okay, so. If convenient, stand, and we'll have you do this. If you can't stand conveniently, maybe sit on the front edge of your chair so that you could sit with the back straight. Imagine yourself being held by a string through the center of your spine up through your head here. So your chest is nice and high. Put one hand on your chest. One hand on your stomach, I'll demonstrate, and then we'll have you do it. Let's see, let's go to the count of 12. I'll demonstrate, and then you'll do it. So I'm going to do it. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. And now I'm going to hold for 4. And then breathe in. Like that. Okay, now you with me. Ready? Here we go.
One, two, three, four, five, six, seven, eight, nine, 10, 11, 12.
Hold for four. One, two, three, four. Did that work? Okay. Let's try that now. Let's sing. Okay? Let's do Jesus Loves Me. We all know that. We don't even have to have the music. Only we're going to do it slightly modified. Here's how we're going to do it. Listen, it'll be something like this. Jesus loves me, this I know. Hold. Breathe. For the... Like that. Okay? All right, so from the beginning. Here we go. Ready? Here we go.
Jesus loves me, this I know.
Handouts now? Anybody still need handout? Raise your hand if you need handout. What's it sound like when you hear an opera? Besides, usually it's in a foreign language.
Strong.
Rich. Loud. That's usually the one right here. Sounds like they're shouting. Why? Because they were shouting. That's right. They had this full auditorium, an orchestra, and a solo person who had to sing loudly enough to be heard over that orchestra and the guy in the back seat who paid his money to be able to hear it. And so they developed a system where they figured out how to sing with tons of volume and for a long period of time. A good opera singer can sing all day long at that volume and not hurt their voice. You know, sometimes at the end of a singing, a song fest or something, you're going, ugh. Okay? With proper vocal technique, you can sing as loudly as you want or as loudly as your neighbor will tolerate for long periods of time and not hurt the vocal mechanism, not hurt your voice. The first aspect of that is proper breathing. With this system of breathing, you can get tons of air, the phrases can last longer, the volume can be richer, and in fact, for the soft parts, it's even more important. You still have to have all of that support, but yet you just tone it down in volume. So we will be working on that from time to time. Let's do the Elijah song. May I have a copy? I guess I don't have it on this one anymore. Okay. I want to do a couple children's songs. This is a children's song. And you may recognize the author. And I think many of you here probably don't even know this song, or if you know the song, you don't know that this was the author. Because he is the kind of person who isn't going to brag about it. But I'll break for him. I think you did a real nice job. I think this is a good song. How many know this song? That's about how many I thought. Okay. All right. This one tells the story of Elijah. And I'll sing the first verse for you. And I do know a sister who thought it was really impolite to look at people over the tops of glasses. But, it looks like you're looking down at them, down your nose at them kind of thing. The way these are set, this is, if I want to see you and the words, I have to do this. So I'm not looking down on you. I'm just trying to see you and the words here. What else do I need? Maybe you. Okay, this tells the story of Elijah. And as far as I know, he wrote the tune too. And as far as I know, I hope I have it notated right. It's one of those things, gets passed down from person to person. And I do know I have the lyrics right because I cornered him last summer and got him to write it down. I couldn't remember for sure the lyrics of verses 4 and 5. And he first of all confirmed that 1 through 3 were correct and he wrote down 4 and 5 for me. No, he saw. I'll sing it for you, so just listen first. No, he saw. I'll try and read it too. There was a man of God who lived a long, long time ago, who told the king there's no more rain unless I say so, to show the king that he was wrong, that God indeed does rain. Elijah, Elijah, Elijah was his name. Okay? Sing with me. We'll sing the first verse again, and then we'll do a few of the verses. Okay? Now, we're seated now, but we don't want all, everything that we just did with breathing to go away. So see if you can sit up. Really, your legs can be bent, and the back still straight, and the ribcage still tall, and all of that. Often sitting at the front edge of the chair can help facilitate that. With your rear about here, on the edge of the chair. Okay, so chest high, breathe from here, the abdomen, breathe in, okay? All right. Do you saw, here we go.
There was a man of God who lived a long, long time ago, who told the king there's no more rain unless I say so, to show the king that he was wrong, that God indeed does reign. On marvels that this prophet stood to prove which God was true. For there was false his prophets lied with fire they could not do. Then this man prayed and fire came down and everybody knew. Elijah, Elijah, our prophet brave and true. Elijah prayed and rain came down upon the thirsty ground. But Ahab's wife said he'd be dead if only he were found. For 40 days he traveled on to find a place to lie. Elijah, Elijah, fear not, God's on your side. Go tell Ahab that they have sinned and they shall surely die. For Jezebel has made the plan and stolen with a lie. And they have killed a very good man and taken what he had. Elijah, Elijah, they surely have been mad. Now God would take this man to have in such a splendid way. His work was done, he had been true, this was his happy day. God sent his fiery chariot down and swept him to the sky. Elijah, Elijah, he did not have to die.
You like this song? I do. Those of you who teach children's classes, work it in. It pretty much tells the whole story. And some local talent. I hear he has more. get these down before they, you know, children's songs are one of those things that we just sort of pass on, and depending on where you go, they sing it a certain way, which I guess that's sort of all right, but also they just sing certain ones, and then sometimes good ones get lost, so let's not let this one get lost. This is your copy to keep, by the way, and so hang on to it, use it again.
Use it as you feel appropriate.
Okay, now let's do this as a little exercise. And I'll let you read the words if you need to. But let's just modify it and do the breathing thing like we do with Jesus Loves Me. So we can work on extending the praise here if we want to. So it'd be something like this. There was a man of God who lived a long, long time ago. Oh. And then the next phrase, like that. Okay. Let me re-pitch here. Don't be so. Ready? Here we go. Breathe. There was a man of God who lived a long, long time ago. Somebody really going to watch the clock for me, because I... Does that work? It's the right time and everything. And I'm to go till 10 after? Okay. I got enough stuff. If you have enough patience, we'll be fine. Get your staff paper, your blank staff paper out. Please. Now, some of this I have done handwritten. Obviously, I needed to... When it was originally a half-hour session, it's now become an hour and 10-minute session. Greg calls me Friday afternoon while we're trying to come across South Dakota to get to Kansas City by Friday night so that we could be to the funeral Saturday morning. Greg calls me on the phone and says, we'd like you to take the entire time that Rick has been allotted so that he can be home with his family, and that all made sense to me. That sounded like a very good decision. Do you have enough stuff? And will you do it? Well, I'm not going to say no. Of course I'm going to do it because it seems to be the right thing to do. Do I have enough stuff? No. But, so some of this, I apologize, some of this is not as, I don't have on this computer the music notation software that I normally use. So I can't just type in some music stuff and print it up and make it look nice and pretty. So some of it's going to look nice and sloppy. So just bear with it. Anyway, so let's talk about some of the names of the notes and all that stuff. And there's actually a system to this. It has some organization to it. And feel free to copy any of this, or all of it, or more. Here up at the first thing, this little thing that looks kind of like an S is called the treble clef. Well, before we get to that, the five lines, the five vertical, the five horizontal parallel lines are called a staff. And upon them we place notes. And the notes tell us two things. They tell us something about pitch, and they tell us something about duration, how long the note is supposed to last. Today we're going to be talking about pitch. High or low? A low note. A high note. Higher note. Okay? And we place them on the staff, vertically up or down, on these lines and spaces, and give them letter names. and each of them represents a specific pitch in our system of music. This little thing here that looks kind of like an S is called a treble clef. It is also called a G clef, which is probably a better name for it, but that's not the name we use most often. We most often call it a treble clef. It used to look like the way they hand wrote the letter G, a stylized G. But the notation systems have gone different ways. The way we write a G has gone a different way than the way we write the treble clef. So it doesn't look kind of much like a G anymore. But it was originally just a G that they put on the staff, and it encircles the second line from the bottom. And the purpose of that is then to tell us where do we place the note G on the staff. The G clef tells us where the note G is. It is the second line from the bottom, and this little circle part of it is to encircle that line. So that's why that's the only note that I've written here, is the note G on the second line from the bottom. When we number lines and spaces, we number from the bottom. And the second line from the bottom is the note G. Now, the system of alphabet that we use the letters A through G, and then we just start over again. So, and as we go up, we go forward through the alphabet. If we go down in pitch, we go backwards through the alphabet. So going forward, the letters would be A, B, C, D, E, F, G, then start over again, A, B, C, D, E, F, G. When we place the notes on the staff, we either place them on a space or on a line. If we go below the staff or above the staff, we add lines, little short lines that we call ledger lines, and we add as many as we need to notate how far below or above the staff the notes are being placed. So here, I have written out some of the notes of the treble clef. Notice the G is right here on the second line from the bottom. From that point, we alternate space, line, space, line, space, line, space, line, etc. And we could keep going. And as we do that, space, line business, we go forward through the alphabet. So after we get to G, we start over again. So the next one above G is A. Then the next one above that is B, C, D, E, F, G. Start over again at A, and then the next one above would be B, etc. From the G, if we go down, we could go backwards through the alphabet. The next letter before G is F, E, D, C. Now, these pitches on the treble clef, basically, these are the pitches that the ladies sing, or boys whose voices haven't changed yet sing. And so the treble clef is for the high voices, the higher voices, the women's voices. In instruments, it's for the higher instruments. The bass clef, well, let me stop. Questions on any of that? Okay, let's go to the bass clef. If the treble clef is for the ladies' voices, the bass clef you think might be for the men's voices, certainly. Okay? And here is the bass clef. It looks kind of like that with two dots. And it is also called the F clef. And again, the way we used to write the F clef, it was just a stylized letter F, just a fancy letter F. But again, the way we've written the clef has gone one direction, and the way we write the letter F in our language has gone another direction, so it doesn't really look like an F at all. I think the G clef looks more like a G than the F clef looks like an F. The two dots tell us where the line is for F. They are on each side of the fourth line from the bottom, denotating the note F. Again, that's why that's the only note that I put there, because that F clef tells me where F is. Then with that in mind, we can write all the notes of the F clef, of the bass clef. Notice there is the F, fourth line from the bottom, that line around which the two dots are placed. From that F, if we go up, forward through the alphabet, G, start over again, A, B, C. Going backwards through the alphabet, F,
E, D, C, B, A. Start over again. G, F, E. Any questions? Now, with a group like this, I look out over this audience and I know there are music teachers here who they learned this years ago, and there are probably some who this may be the first time they've seen it. So we have all levels here, and so it, don't be insulted if I'm teaching something very beginning. That's I'm doing that on purpose. And if I zoom past, just stop me and slow me down so I can pat you back up. I don't want there to be gaps in what we present. Because I actually am going to zoom in just a minute here, or at least present one concept, which is probably not what you thought I would do next. Okay, now, it just so happens, see, notice we have a couple of notes with the same name, C has eight arms, or tentacles, octagon has eight sides, the stop sign is an octagon with an eight-sided polygon, okay, and octave has eight notes, if you count the beginning and ending one, C, D, E, F, G, A, B, C is 8. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. When we number intervals, when we measure intervals, the distance between notes, pitch-wise, we start counting with 1. Now that may seem obvious to you, but often when we measure things, we don't start at 1. If I were to measure the length of this table in feet, this would not be 1 foot. This would be 0. If I'm measuring from this end. And the 1 foot mark would be out here. Okay, but when we measure distance in pitch, we start with 1, not at 0. So an octave, we call it 8 notes, but it's really only 7 steps. Anyway, that'll sort of become important and something I'm going to mention in just a minute. Now, what's that mean? What's that sound like? Let's see if I can do an octave here. So, do, this part doesn't have to be do. I'll call it do. We'll say we're in the key of C. So, do, 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 do. Okay? It's that, even though we name them the same, there's a big difference between those pitches. Do, 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 mi, so, do. Now, it just so happens, this C we call middle C. And this C is the exact same pitch as this C. The C that's the first line above the bass clef is the exact same note, not an octave difference, the exact same note as this C that is the line below the treble clef. So it is in the middle between the two staves. What was that? Is staves? Between the two staves is the middle C. Do, do, that note. And then if we went up for that, I can't hit that with any, I'm not even going to try, but do, mi, so, do, is that one. Okay? Doesn't that sound useful? and that's then in the women's range. Okay? All right. Questions? Okay, next. Let's talk about seventh chords. Because that's obviously the next thing we need to talk about. First of all, now we put a treble clef staff above a bass clef staff and bracket them together, and we sometimes call these two together the grand staff, where we have the notes for the men on the bottom and the notes for the women on the top. Then I chose to write a G7 chord here, a G major minor 7 chord or dominant 7 chord, sometimes called, and unfortunately, I was a little sloppy with the note G. We've written a couple of ledger lines below, and so 1, 2, 3 spaces below the line is G, and then B, and then D, and then F. Those 4 notes make a G7 chord, G, B, D, F. When we build chords, typically we build them in thirds, and 4 thirds make a 7th. Four thirds make a seventh. Watch. And the difficulty with this math is because we don't start at zero. We start at one when we count. G to B. G, A, B. That's a third. B to D. B, D, F is a third. I skipped in thirds. I said that wrong. Let me start over. G to B. G, A, B is a third. B to D. B, C, D is a third. D to F. D, E, F is a third. So we have four notes. Actually, we have three thirds. Four notes. But G to F, G, A, B, C, D, E, F is a seventh. Okay? That's a G7 chord. Now, let's see if I can sing that for you, at least the broken. Do, mi, so, te. Do, mi, so, te. Okay? G7 chord, G major minor chord. This chord, by nature, provides tension for us, tension for the composer. Look what happens when we move the G from here, up an octave, to here. Now we have an F and a G right next to it. Still the same notes, G, B, D, and F. We have an F and a G right next to each other. What's the interval between F and G? A second. We like thirds, because thirds build snowmen for us. See, that's a four ball snowman. Thirds build snowmen for us. We like snowmen. They sound nice when we sing them. But we have a second there. And a second is a snowman that doesn't fit. And a second provides some tension for us. Samuel, may I call on you, please? Songbooks. 269, I think. No? I don't remember what the number was. I'll just bring it up here. I think it says 239. 239. 3 minutes? Okay. We'll stop with this demonstration then.
May I ask a
question?
When you say thirds, is that a fraction or a fourth of the fraction?
Good. Good question, yes. Because in our language, again, it could be either way. Thirds means ordinal. First, second, third, not a fraction, 1/3. Okay? This interval of a third is a counting distance of the first, the second, the third note. Okay, not a fraction of 1/3 of something, because it's not really 1/3 of anything. Well, not really, no, it's not 1/3 of anything. We could call it a fraction of something, but it wouldn't be a third anyway. Okay, you know this song, Sam? Okay, something's frown.
Okay. One more time.
there. Be sure, when we sing this tomorrow, that you can hear those. If you're singing bass or tenor so loud that you cannot hear that between the alto and soprano part, you're missing it. Just like we, when a good story writer will have tension somewhere, conflict somewhere in the story, a good composer will put tension and conflict in the music. And it's right there, and we'll talk more about that next time. Questions before we dismiss?
Thank you.
Thank you.